This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the treatment of vitiligo with dermatologist Dr. Yvette Miller-Monthrope. We'll learn how to fix your inner monologue with psychologist and author Faust Ruggiero. We'll learn about music as medicine with holistic healer and author Geraldine Glass. And lastly, we'll discover the signs that your loved ones might need some emotional support with holistic healer and author Bradley Nelson. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. Doctors are now saying that weight loss shouldn't always be the main goal when it comes to health. For years, people with higher body weight were told to lose weight through diet and exercise. But research shows that most people can't keep the weight off over the long term. Even worse, focusing only on weight can lead to stress, harmful eating habits, and mental health issues. Experts say that weight doesn't always show how healthy someone is. In fact, someone trying hard to lose weight can actually increase weight stigma when people are judged just because of their size. This stigma can cause more harm than good sometimes. Doctors are now encouraging a different approach called health at every size. This idea supports healthy habits like good nutrition and regular activity without focusing only on the number on the scale. Studies show that it can improve eating habits and mental well-being. In the end, doctors still believe in healthy lifestyles, but they want to focus more on the individual's needs and not just their weight. The goal is better overall care and not just weight loss. I'll be joined by Dr. Yvette Miller-Monthrope in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. Living with a chronic skin disease can come with a lot of personal challenges. In some instances, itching, scratching, and even scarring. Some people might think you're contagious, spreading an infectious disease. Vitiligo is a skin disease that can cause some physical difficulty and even some emotional pain. Today, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Yvette Miller-Monthrope, a dermatologist and dermatopathologist, I hope I pronounced that right, practicing at the Diverse Skin Types and Pigmentation Disorder Clinic at Women's College Hospital in Toronto. Welcome to the show, Dr. Miller-Monthrope. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and thank you for that introduction, and thank you for having me.
So, vitiligo, what's that?
So the simplest definition, I would say, of vitiligo is a medical condition that causes a person's skin to lose pigment and turn white. But, you know, a more precise sort of medical definition of vitiligo would be a chronic autoimmune disease, and that leads to the destruction of the body's pigment-producing cells, which are called melanocytes. And then that leads to this patchy depigmentation or whitening of the skin.
So I think I've seen this before. I didn't know it by name. Is this sort of like, it's not a uniform discoloration, right? It's sort of patchy. Is that right?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Typically, vitiligo, the most common type of vitiligo that is, presents with patchy, symmetric patches of white skin that just start showing up over time on both sides of the body.
Does it itch or does it hurt?
So one of the things about vitiligo is, thankfully, most patients do not complain of pain or itch or anything like that, or any sort of symptoms, physical symptoms, although rarely some patients may say it's slightly itchy. The biggest thing with vitiligo is the mental and the emotional impact that this condition has on many patients.
So what are common symptoms other than sort of the discoloration? Is there anything else, or is that pretty much what defines the disease?
The disease is pretty much defined by pigment depigmentation, the white patches, and the emotional impact that goes along with it.
Okay. I suppose that there would be emotional challenges to living with it, right? Because it's appearance, right? People see you and therefore, you know, they draw conclusions, right? And you can't always speak to those people, like if you're walking down the street, right?
100%. And so that's the biggest part of vitiligo and why it's such a challenging and difficult condition for so many of our patients. And, you know, you had mentioned, Jamie, that you think you've seen it, and you probably have, because vitiligo affects at least 1-2% of the world's population. So, you know, every 1 in 100 people you may see, like, will have, this probably has vitiligo. So I'm not surprised that you've seen people with it. And in terms of, you know, how it's affecting our patients, there's been, you know, from the time that vitiligo has been something that people have been noticing for millennia, centuries. And in the past, there were many, many misconceptions. And unfortunately, those continue. So in the past, people thought this was a contagious disease like leprosy. And many of these patients or these individuals would be isolated from their society or their culture. And, you know, these individuals may have also experienced things like an inability to meet with a romantic partner or have a romantic partner or a spouse because of the social stigma that's associated with it. Vitiligo tends to be associated with other comorbidities like depression or anxiety. And so, you know, the main challenge for patients with vitiligo is this emotional pain, the social stigma, and its associations. Even patients with vitiligo tend to have even higher amounts of depression and anxiety than even some of our other very common and very distressing skin conditions like psoriasis or eczema, for example.
And I imagine it would be very challenging for somebody with darker complexion, just because it would be more evident, I would presume. Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And so vitiligo affects people of all skin tones equally. So it really doesn't matter about skin tone in terms of the percentage of people affected. However, you're absolutely correct. When you have someone with a deeper skin tone and they have these white patches, it's much more obvious. And this leads to more embarrassment than someone who, say, has a lighter skin tone and then they get the vitiligo patches. That being said, I have patients of every skin tone in my practice, and the emotional impact is present for people of all skin tones. But you are correct in that for patients who have darker skin, they tend to have even slightly higher, symptoms such as depression and feeling socially isolated and things like that.
Hmm. So is this something you're born with? Is this something you contract? Is it viral? Is it genetic? How does one get vitiligo?
Okay, so vitiligo, it's an autoimmune disease. So this is related to the body's immune system. But I kind of like to think of vitiligo sort of occurring because of three main things. So first, you have a genetic predisposition. So there's been more than 50 genes that have been associated with vitiligo that have been discovered to date. And so someone who has one of those genes that's been given to them by their parents, et cetera, like, or their family members, or it's in their family, they are more predisposed to having vitiligo. Then the next part is that, you know, oxidative stress or just stressors from the environment can cause sort of an inflammatory response, which leads to the destruction of these pigment producing cells, which are called melanocytes. And then you get the physical kind of response, the white patches on the skin. And so, you know, when you think of genetic predisposition and then you have this inflammatory response and then you get the physical findings. And when I say autoimmune, I mean that for some reason that person's genetics predisposes them to their own body's immune system attacking their own body's pigment producing cells or melanocytes. And that's really how people get vitiligo. That's what we know about its pathogenesis so far.
How is it diagnosed? Do you have to have a flare up in order to be diagnosed with it, or can you get in front of it?
Great question. Unfortunately, there's no way to prevent vitiligo. And so it is diagnosed once one of those patches appears on the skin. And typically it's diagnosed by a healthcare practitioner. And, you know, there are many, many things that can cause lightening of the skin or lighter patches on the skin. But vitiligo is unique in that it causes complete whitening of the skin. And so it's very, very clinically, we just diagnose this clinically. It looks like a white sheet of paper. And so Other things that can be used sort of in the clinic, there's something called a Wood's lamp, which is a blue light that can be shone in a dark room. And that kind of shows how white and how kind of stark white those patches are. And that's particularly helpful for our patients with vitiligo who have lighter skin tones. Rarely, and you know, we dermatologists or other healthcare practitioners can do a skin biopsy to confirm the presence of vitiligo, but that's rarely necessary. A skin biopsy, it would show the actual absence of those melanocytes in that tiny piece of skin under a microscope. And the only reason we would really consider doing a skin biopsy is to make sure that, you know, we're not missing something else, because as I mentioned, not everything that's lighter on the skin is vitiligo. So that's also important to know. There is what we call in medicine a differential diagnosis sometimes. And so there are other things that can cause whitening of the skin or lightening of the skin. And so sometimes a skin biopsy may be needed to kind of help with that.
Is it treatable?
It is treatable. And unfortunately, for many years, vitiligo patients have just been kind of sent on their way by their healthcare providers who have told them, you know, this is just cosmetic. There's nothing that can be done. And, you know, sadly, it takes up to 2 to 2.5 years to actually get a diagnosis for most patients with vitiligo, because they've been, you know, this misconception not only exists amongst, you know, people in society, but also amongst even healthcare practitioners. It's for years, it was just considered a cosmetic issue and that there was no treatment. But this is certainly not true. There are treatments available. And, you know, we typically it's an approach that, you know, requires education and working alongside the healthcare practitioner with their patients to explain to them what they're to expect for their condition. And then, you know, there are sort of things that one can do in their lifestyle to kind of help prevent worsening or flares. There are also topical treatments that are available. We have our first FDA/Health Canada approved topical treatment was recently approved back in October of last year. There are in certain types of vitiligo, there are systemic or pills that may be necessary to get the condition under control. If the vitiligo is very stable, there are surgical procedures that can be done. And so, you know, there are many, many different treatment modalities. And so really the key is that the patient needs to be diagnosed correctly and sent to the right healthcare practitioner who can then help them manage their condition.
Is it treatable in the sense that it's reversible, or is it treatable in the sense you can manage it?
So unfortunately, all autoimmune or chronic inflammatory conditions, they are controllable to an extent, but curable, not so much. And okay. So once treatment has been initiated, we can certainly get the condition under control. But in terms of saying that they'll never get another patch of vitiligo again, that's we haven't yet found the treatment that can do that. The other thing is just mentioning about vitiligo, unlike many of our other skin conditions, you know, I tell all my patients that vitiligo management treatment is a marathon and not a sprint, because in terms of getting those melanocytes to wake up, the ones that are going to repigment the skin, it takes a very, very long time. We're talking months to over a year of persistent treatment.
I would imagine that it's important that you catch it earlier rather than later, because it would be easier, I guess, to manage and perhaps treat. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. The earlier that it's diagnosed, the faster we can kind of get the patient on a good treatment regimen. And then as soon as they see any new patches coming up, they can start treating it right away.
I understand you recently co-authored a new Canadian consensus guideline for the management of vitiligo. What were some of the key findings from that?
Yeah, so that was a great experience. Myself and 9 other colleagues from across the country who all have interest in vitiligo and see many patients with vitiligo, you know, we co-authored these consensus guidelines for Canadians. And, you know, our main treatment goals really were revolved around sort of 6 main things. And so, you know, educating the patient about their condition, talking about lifestyle changes, as I mentioned earlier, oxidative stress and things like that can sort of trigger vitiligo initially, in the patient with the right genetic makeup. And so some, there's been some small studies about different vitamins and antioxidants that may kind of help with that. Avoiding things like trauma to the skin, because vitiligo does something called Kebnerize, which means that in areas of trauma, where someone has injured their skin or they've burned their skin, for example, they can get patches of vitiligo. Also, just letting the patients know that this is a long process and that it will take time to treat, giving them all of their options for management, and making it really a partnership with the patient and the dermatologist or the healthcare practitioner that is taking care of them. Other parts of the guidelines included making sure that we discuss some of the comorbidities. So I didn't really go into this too much, but patients with vitiligo have a quite an increased risk of developing other autoimmune conditions, most commonly autoimmune thyroid disease. So addressing this and making sure that that's looked into as well. Also addressing the mental health aspects, maybe we, sometimes we may need to liaise with other practitioners, psychiatrists, psychologists, to help the patients manage that mental health aspect of their condition. And then moving on to the repigmentation. So that would be some of the topical creams. I just mentioned that we have one that's FDA approved, but in the past, non sort of approved topical anti-inflammatory agents like topical steroids, topical calcineurin inhibitors, et cetera, which are like those were used in the past with some success, knowing that, even light therapy is another modality that can be used. And so just kind of coming up with the best approach for the patient, monitoring the activity. And so many of us who treat a lot of patients with vitiligo will do serial photographs, because when vitiligo does repigment, so when you have those big sort of white patches, it tends to repigment in a speckled pattern, usually where hair follicles are, because typically the immune system, the hair follicles are sort of protected from those autoimmune cells that are attacking, the pigment producing cells. So when we get back pigment, it usually comes back first around hair follicles and then spreads outwards to fill in the whole patch. So, monitoring that. And so once we start seeing those little dots, we know that we're kind of on the right path. And then, once the patient is stable, like maintaining that over a long time. So all of my vitiligo patients are long-term patients. They're not, it's not something we can kind of just diagnose and then not see the patient ever again. Or, it's something that's, these are all long-term patients. So those were the main sort of goals and findings of the consensus guidelines, just making sure that we adhere to kind of those six main factors.
What do you see as the biggest need when it comes to vitiligo?
I think the biggest need, I mean, I don't, there's many needs in vitiligo, but this is also my passion. So,
Yep.
but I think in terms of, I think we definitely need more education. So opportunities just like this one, thank you again for having me, and just to educate the public, that vitiligo is not an infectious disease. It is not something to kind of be afraid of. People with vitiligo are like everyone else, and just educating even healthcare practitioners who aren't aware that this is truly a disease and just not a quote unquote cosmetic issue. Creating partnerships with patient groups and things like that. There are some that have been created, but just further strengthening those. We need more treatment. So as I mentioned, we only have one FDA and Canada Health approved topical therapy for vitiligo to date, but there are some sort of that may be coming out in the next few years, which is great, but we need so many more. Many of our other skin conditions have, many tens and 20 therapies that can be used and that are effective. We need this in vitiligo. Vitiligo affects so many people, and it causes such distress for so many people that we need the healthcare practitioners, the public, everybody to be on board. The government agencies need to be on board to support direct treatments and therapies, because, you know, these therapies can be very expensive. And, you know, because of this sort of, you know, people thinking that this is just a cosmetic issue because it doesn't have significant pain or itch, you know, even government agencies aren't always quick to want to support treatments in this treatments for this condition, which is really disappointing. So, you know, I know I didn't really say one, what is the biggest need, but I think there are many, many needs still, because this is sort of, we're in the infancy stages of kind of really combating vitiligo.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. I'd love to come back.
For more information about vitiligo, you can go to canadianskin.ca. or at Vitiligo Voices Canada. That was Dr. Yvette Miller-Monthrope. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss your internal language on The Tonic.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including Argan, Rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Foss Ruggiero's professional career spans almost 40 years and is diversified and compelling, as it has consistently established new and exciting cutting-edge counseling programs in pursuit of professional excellence and personal life enhancement. Faust is a published research author, clinical trainer, and therapist who has worked in settings that have included clinics for deaf children, prisons, nursing homes, substance abuse centers, inpatient facilities, major corporations, both national and international, and as the president of the Community Psychological Center in Bangor, Pennsylvania. In that capacity, he's developed the Process Way of Life Counseling Program and has developed it into a formal text presented in the Fix Yourself Handbook series, including his latest book, Fix Your Internal Language Handbook. Welcome back to the show, sir. How are you?
Thanks so much for inviting me. I am well. How about yourself?
Getting there. Let's talk about people who may not be doing so well, maybe suffering from depression. How can someone manage their depression?
Well, you know, the first thing I tell everyone, Jamie, is let's start with the physical. Let's make sure you get yourself to a doctor. Let's make sure there's no physical things that are playing into it. And then from that point, it's the typical basic fundamental stuff that we want to focus on, getting the proper amount of sleep, the proper diet, exercise if possible. Doing those things that create a healthy body always get in the way of depression.
People talk about, you know, finding their internal balance. How would you define what an internal balance is?
I talked about it in depth. For me, it is about getting your physical, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual attributes in balance. And by doing that, it just means keeping all of those attributes healthy. I mentioned healthy body. When it comes to emotion, it's learning how to get your intellect over your emotion. Let's give yourself some time to get the facts and not overreact to things. Intellectually, we want clarity of thought. So anything that gets in the way of you having clear thoughts, like not enough sleep, like drug and alcohol abuse, you know, things like that get in the way of your intellect. You want to kind of phase those out and then start working with fact finding and being real honest with yourself. That helps a lot. Spiritually, some people embrace it, some people don't. But for me, I always tell people, at least give it a try. If nothing else, try to get connect with the deeper parts of yourself.
Why do you think it's important that we find that internal balance? Like, what happens if we don't?
If we don't, then we have those days where we're overly emotional, where we don't have clarity of thought, we're overreacting, we're concerned about what's going to happen next. We're talking to ourselves negatively. We're angry, depressed, a lot of anxiety, those types of things. These are all the outgrowths of a body of a person whose attributes are not in balance.
Let's talk a bit about external factors. So how does stress come into play with respect to somebody's mood or mental acuity, et cetera?
Well, stress is again, the physical, intellectual, emotional reaction to something, as opposed to being able to put it in a proper perspective so that we can deal with it. When we are stressed, we raise cortisol levels in the body. We stress every part of the system. And it's not just, your nerves. Your muscles get stressed. Your bones, the whole structurally, you're stressed. Intellectually, you can't think. Emotionally, you're overreacting. The stress on the body in an hour, Jamie, is more pronounced than 8 hours of reasonable physical labor.
Okay. So your newest book is about internal language. Can you explain what internal language is for our listeners so they can put it into context of this conversation?
Sure. And any healthy person, or I mean healthy people who are not affected by mental diseases or developmental problems, we think, if we can be verbal, we think with language. So that in our brain, what we're thinking with is either positive or negative or neutral, take your pick. But what happens is we have a tendency to kick things around in our heads, and we often don't focus on the real positive things. We have a tendency to focus on who hurt us and old pains and what we're fearing and all those kinds of things. We're angry at someone. We may have internal conversations, either with ourselves or with that person in our own mind. So what I want people to do is learn how to stop the negative internal language, move to a more positive way of doing things. Doesn't have to mean you're telling yourself you love yourself all the time. It just simply means that the conversation in your head, the language you're using, isn't working against you.
But isn't it that you're having the negative thoughts and it's manifesting in the negative language as opposed to the language manifesting the thought? I mean, I live in my head. I'm one of those people who stews. And if I have a quiet moment, I am turning over these ideas. And I agree with you. They tend to be negative. But I feel like it's emotion driving thought as opposed to thought driving emotion.
Well, you're right. And what I always ask people is, I said, okay, you're in your head and you're doing all this conversing in your head, this working things out. Are you goal oriented when you're doing that? Are you working towards some type of a solution? And are you then able to turn it off and implement whatever you need to do to arrive at a solution? Most of the time they'll tell me no. And the way you know that is because you keep on spinning the thought. If it's productive thought, even if it borders on what's negative, it should move to a positive approach. Okay, I don't like this, but I'm going to do this. So I solve this and I don't keep spinning this in my head.
I have been known to script out revenge fantasies if I'm upset with somebody. I think people do that too. I actually do tend towards, I don't know if I would call it finding solutions, but perhaps actions. But I find myself repeating those scenarios, and I'm wondering if that's helpful.
Well, if you repeat the scenario and it brings you to a conclusion, a positive conclusion, that's great. But here's what will happen when those of us that are dealing with, revenge fantasies, whatever they may be, if they're working against us, what we find is it's an autopilot thing. We didn't even introduce the thought. We didn't say, I'm going to think about this. All of a sudden, we're just in the conversation in our head and it's not stopping. And the other thing we find is when it's working against us is that we get emotional and our body gets a little tighter. Now we're, the whole person's getting involved in this thing. What I want people to be able to do is say, okay, you're going to have things that don't go well. Your internal conversation should be reviewing the facts, should be saying, okay, based on this, I need to do this and then try to make that happen. And if you can do that, that's great. If you can't do that, then what I tell people is get it out of your head. You're stuck. Then go talk to someone. Doesn't have to be a counselor. It can be, but a best friend, a family member, someone you trust, and say, this is what I'm spinning here and I'm getting angry and I can't stop it. Help me out.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mind having the thoughts. I find, you know, they'll come when I'm walking my dog, like if I'm on my own, like I'm not having conversations with my dog per se, but, you know, like I'm thinking about things as I'm walking and things pop into my head. And I'm sure I'm not alone. Everybody has these thoughts that fly into your head and you don't know where they're coming from. And I don't mind the time to think them over. I guess the question becomes, what does one do if those thoughts keep, if they can't control the thoughts that are coming in or they're not coming to resolution? What would you say to somebody who's experiencing that?
Well, what I try to get people to do is three easy steps. And that determines whether or not you need some help beyond what you're doing with yourself. The first thing I talk about is just stopping the thought.
Okay.
That's just getting in the way of it. And it's a decision. I am not going to think about this. Consciously, you're going to say that. I'm not going to think about this. Then switch to a different thought. Okay. And then when you're there, okay, I'm going to think about this. Now develop that thought and see if you can keep that going. If that happens, then you're beginning to control your brain. Now, the thing you want to understand is that this is a training program. This isn't I went home yesterday. I tried this and my God, it worked this time and everything's better. The thoughts will keep coming back. It's training your brain not to do it because you already trained your brain to do the negative thinking. Now you're going to train your brain to go the other direction. If that starts to work for you, you can probably control this. If it doesn't, if you can't stop the thought, think of something new and develop that thought, you probably need to sit down with someone and start working these things out, because it may not just be that thought. You may have a lot of old pain that isn't closed, undercurrents of things in your past that haven't been settled, victimization, those types of things. So you want to go see that those aren't coming in and contaminating the whole exercise.
Yeah. And I assume you're not suggesting to people that they ignore these thoughts that are coming into their head, because there's a reason they're coming into their head, right?
Exactly. They're there for a reason. And what happens is typically they'll come in because something has happened. Or when we get to the point that the negative language gets so bad, oftentimes we become those thinkers. So it's a little bit of each there, things are real, they happen, but sometimes we're people who can begin to think in our head and we realize, I don't know how I got here, but I'm in an angry mood. My dialogue's angry. Well, if that's the case, again, there's some other things going on in your life, and I'm not telling you that it's terrible. Your life is in disarray. I'm just saying you have something you're doing that's getting in the way of your happiness, and there are ways to deal with it.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much for coming on the show to explain that.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for asking me.
That was Fausto Ruggiero. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the healing power of music on The Tonic. For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more, and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of the Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Geraldine Glass is an internationally acclaimed singer, pioneer figure in the realm of sound healing, creator of the Source app, and author of Sacred Vibrations, The Transformative Power of Crystalline Sound and Music. Before coming one of the foremost leaders in the world of holistic healing through music as medicine, Geraldine got her start in the theater and Broadway and graced opera and concert stages across Europe and around the globe. Later, she founded Crystal Cadence, a dedicated sound healing studio housing the Los Angeles Crystal Tones Singing Bowl Temple of Alchemy. Her work in the field of sound has had tremendous impact on mental health, cancer, and hospice patients, as well as children and veterans. Following the tragic loss of her only son, Geraldine decided to write her book, Sacred Vibrations, as a guide to engaging music as medicine and how the power of sound can serve to transform us. Sacred Vibrations guides readers on their journey of integrated and wholeness through actionable tips, relaxing and effective meditations accessible through QR codes, wisdom from leading scientists, esteemed colleagues, and more. Wow. Welcome to the show, Geraldine. How are you?
Thank you so much, Jamie. Wonderful to be here.
So how does music act as medicine? What do you mean by that?
I think that music can help us to feel things that we don't want to feel, but things that are necessary that we feel, because if we keep pushing them away, they're going to keep getting buried deeper and deeper and can really hurt us in the end.
We do little science tidbits off the top of the show, and one not too long ago was how music resonates physically within the body, like not just in our brains, but physically attunes our body. Is that part of the work you do, or is that something else?
Oh, yes. And I often ask the question is, how do we tune ourselves? Like when my piano gets out of tune, I call the piano tuner.
Right.
But when we as human beings get out of tune, no one really teaches us how do we bring ourselves back to harmony. And so when an illness happens in the body, there's part of you that's not in tune. And working with the Crystal Singing Bowls has helped me greatly to not even having to know exactly where it is in the body, but help to bring tuning, help to bring the body back into homeostasis.
Do you help people who are grieving?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I just played for a group of grieving mothers last weekend. And yes, because sound helps your mind to focus. You know, you hear sound and you say, wow, that's music. And yet the music steals your mind. And in the moment that you steal your mind, you can come in because you feel safe to feel. And that's what happened with me with my own grief. The music and the sounds of the Crystal Singing Bowls really helped my mind to quiet itself and stop being in fight or flight. And suddenly I was safe to breathe and feel the grief. And I could express it, and then it dissipated.
Hmm. Well, I mean, that's interesting. I'm kind of in a grieving state right now. So it's part of the reason for bringing you on the show, candidly. So this is personal to me. So what is sound meditation, and what's its benefit?
So sound meditation, once again, is being in a relaxed situation that sound can bring you to. And again, that it quiets your mind, because our minds are so busy worrying about this, fearful about this, doubting of this, questioning this, right? So it quiets the mind and it gives it a sense of deep peace. And in those moments of deep peace, and you're breathing deeply in your body, as you were saying, every cell of you receives the sound. And if you think about that, we're approximately 70% water, and the sound makes these beautiful sacred geometry shapes when we look at it under such an instrument as a cymoscope. And that is happening in the very fluids of our bodies. It helps to bring a deep sense of peace, is what I've experienced, whether it's with veterans, cancer patients, hospice patients, children, the average human being that just needs a place to find stillness and feel strong and centered inside.
So I may have buried the lead, but I'll sort of approach this question the way I did off the top. And that is there science behind crystalline sound and singing bowls?
Oh, yes. And sound as, yes. And I'm working together with Minerva University to further that. But because the crystal instruments are fairly new, there's not as much research on them, but research on music as medicine Yes, there is. You know, showing that it can reduce the cortisol level, it can produce more leukocytes in the blood, it can help bring more oxygen to the blood. So yes, there is definitely science, and it's a miracle to me when I see what happens to pretty much anyone that I play the bowls for, no matter what kind of deep state they're in.
How can we use our body as an instrument? Because I know that's part of what you teach and what you espouse.
Well, I mean, we are a human instrument. And once again, if you think about that, each of us has our own unique vibrational signature. So me being a singer, each of us has our own unique sound. And I feel that part of our responsibility as a human being is to understand, okay, what is my human instrument? Again, is it in tune? How do I create harmony for myself? And then how do I express that unique vibrational signature freely and grounded and feel it in my body, that I am this vibrating string. I am this human instrument.
Is everybody capable of being in harmony like that? Like, so for example, if you can't carry a tune, could you still be in harmony?
Oh yeah. It has nothing to do with, if you are a singer or such, because everybody can hum. And there's much research done of what humming can do for the body in terms of bringing, creating more oxytocin, bringing a deep sense of relaxation, again, reducing cortisol production. So everyone can hum. But of course, each human being must make the decision that I want to set an intention for health, for wholeness, for more peace in my life. It's not that it just comes automatically, although I have seen some of the, you know, bigger skeptics suddenly experience a sound bath and go, what happened? Where did I go? Why do I feel this way? So it's both.
Do you, how shall I put this? I want to sort of phrase it in a way that makes sense. Like, do you play different music depending on the purpose?
Or absolutely.
Yeah? Okay.
Absolutely. So, you know, not to get too deep into it, but as a musician, you know, there's many different musical keys.
Of course,
and
yeah.
there's different tunings. You know, we talk about the tuning of 432 hertz. The tuning of music today is 440 hertz. There's another tuning called 528 hertz that we can work with. So yes, it's very personalized. And I think, Jamie, it's important that we understand there's no one size fits all. You know, you might love to listen to Frank Sinatra, Fly Me to the Moon, and I might love to listen to Lena Horne or the Beethoven Ninth Symphony. Someone else might listen to rap, or it's as individual as we are. And it's important to find what music rocks you, you know, what music really inspires you.
Yeah. Could I ask you to play the crystal bowls for the listeners?
Absolutely. So this set is in the key of C. Just take a listen. Okay. And then depending on what patterns I create, what melodies I create, do I play a deeply grounding bowl? Centering bowl, a higher bowl that helps expand. Vibrations are long. They're long and they can be very, have a lot of overtones to them. And for me, playing the singing bowls is really about making music that helps people to feel safe, to drop in, as you said, you know, when you asked about embodiment, to drop in and really feel what's going on. Where is the pain, whether it's physical or emotional? Where is the frustration? Where is the anger? Oh, it's located in my lower abdomen. Oh, it's in my chest. Oh, it's in my right shoulder. Where is that? And then you breathe and allow the sound to move within you.
Well, thank you for that. That was really beautiful.
And you're most welcome. Whenever I get started, it's like, oh, let's go, let's go. You know, so we've created a YouTube channel where there's lots of, there's a free library of all different kinds of sound baths in different keys with different emphasis, and there's different alchemies in them. So it does make a difference what kind of music you listen to with the bowls and how it feels to you.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You are most welcome. Thank you for having me.
We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the signs that your loved ones need emotional support on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more, and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Veteran holistic physician Dr. Bradley Nelson, DC, retired, is one of the world's foremost experts on natural methods of achieving wellness. He's the creator of the Emotion Code, the Body Code, and the Belief Code, and the CEO of Discover Healing, a holistic education platform that provides training and certifies practitioners worldwide. His best-selling book, The Emotion Code, provides step-by-step instructions for working with the body's energy healing power. His latest book, The Body Code, Unlocking Your Body's Ability to Heal Itself, which was published in 2003, is also available. For more information, you can visit discoverhealing.com. Welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
Well, fantastic, Jamie. Thanks for having me on.
So what are signs that your loved one might need some emotional support?
Well, if they've recently gone through some kind of a distressing event or a big life change, such as a job loss, loss of a loved one, moving, or some other challenging experience, they may need some emotional support. If you notice changes in their mood or their behavior, maybe your friend is just not as up and peppy as he or she normally is. If you notice that maybe the person that you care about isn't showing up to events, they're isolating themselves. They don't want to go anywhere. They don't want to go for a walk. They don't want to go to the movies or out to dinner. If they're losing interest in their hobbies, if they become more irritable, they probably need some emotional support. And also your own intuition can tell you, you know these people, you know your friends, you know your loved ones, and you can tell if something is off if you're paying attention. You might feel an inexplicable need to care for them, or your intuition might just tell you something is not quite right with Susie or Bob. So there are things that you can do. Number one most important thing is to listen. One of the most important things that you can do for them is to just listen to them. Don't feel pressured to fix the situation. Don't try to fix it. Don't try to cheer them up. Don't try to provide solutions. Just be present with them so that they can feel heard and cared about. Oftentimes, when people have some kind of a problem going on in their life, they just need somebody to talk to, somebody to listen to them. And if you immediately jump to trying to solve the problem, then they feel less heard. And it can feel like, well, you're just trying to get this over with and you're not really interested. So another thing that you can do is remember to be patient with people, because healing is often not linear. It can take time. You need to be patient with their healing process. But if you feel like they're still really struggling a lot and are not improving, it might be a good time to guide them towards seeing a professional. That's what professionals are there for. And when you connect someone like that with helpful resources, it depends, you know, on what they are experiencing, but it can be really helpful to point them to energy healing. What we have found with the emotion code and the body code and the belief code is that they are dealing with the body in terms of energy medicine, and energy is what our bodies are really made out of. And so what we have found is that things like depression and anxiety and phobias and panic attacks and post-traumatic stress and eating disorders and self-sabotage of all kinds respond really, really well to energy medicine. And the simplest energy medicine that exists really in the world right now, in our experience, is the emotion code. The emotion code is a really simple way that anyone can actually learn and use. It's simple enough that kids can do it. And so we have seen people all over the world deal with all kinds of these mental and emotional issues very successfully themselves. And so, in fact, had dinner recently with a woman. My wife and I were in San Diego and had dinner with a woman who was on the Chicago Police Department for about 5 or 6 years and was so traumatized with everything that she'd seen. She couldn't keep working, so she left the force. And she became deeply suicidal and battled that consistently for a number of years, tried all kinds of different things. Nothing really worked. Her mother told her about the emotion code, and she decided she would try the emotion code, and she was going to give it 90 more days to live. So she wrote out her suicide note, dated 90 days in the future, started using the emotion code, and within 45 days, her suicidal depression was completely gone, just working on herself. And so remember that professionals are there. If a friend of yours is really suicidal, for example, you should refer them to somebody or have them call a suicide hotline. But I tell that story because there are things that can be done that are out of the realm of most people's experience now. We're in the year 2025, and there are some really advanced methods of energy medicine that can really make a difference for people. So recognizing when a loved one needs help, healing emotionally can take a bit of attention, as often people may not directly ask for help. In fact, they usually won't. So look for those subtle signs and listen to them, and try to be there for them and provide support in any way that you can. And remember, often just listening is what most people need.
What about somebody who's in emotional distress, you know, because of a failed relationship, like a broken heart? Is that something that can be fixed with energy healing?
Well, yes, absolutely. In fact, it's a very interesting thing, but we now are beginning to understand that the heart is everything the ancients believed it to be. They believed long ago that the heart was the seat of love and creativity and romance, and that it was really the core of our being. We've pretty much ignored those old ideas in Western medicine, but now we're beginning to understand. For example, we now know that the heart has a lot of gray matter and white matter in it, 40,000 dendrites, brain tissue essentially in the heart. And when people have a heart transplant, they often find that they now have the affinities and the memories and the loves of the donor, some of the memories of the things that they really cared about. There are books written about this. It's called cellular memory. One of the things that we have found is that emotional energies will cluster around the heart sometimes, creating something that we call a heart wall. And so when you go through these experiences and you feel like your heart is going to break and there's a physical sensation there, oftentimes you'll end up with what we call a heart wall. But it is really a fascinating thing that people actually can die from a broken heart. They discovered this in Japan. They call it Takotsubo syndrome. Takotsubo is a little Japanese jar the fishermen use to catch octopus, and the heart will actually assume the shape of this jar when a person is actually having a heart attack. Their heart is actually failing, but it's actually what we now call cardiac syndrome, where the heart, it's not really a typical heart attack. It happens typically to women over 55 who have gone through some kind of intense event, and it actually can be fatal, but it's literally dying from a broken heart. And we now know that that's true, and Western medicine recognizes that as well. So if you feel like you're having a heart attack, by all means, call 911. But you may also have emotional baggage that is affecting you, and we think that by removing that emotional baggage, you may be able to prevent that from happening to you. And, you know, we've all gone through difficult things, and some of us more difficult than others. So it's all explained in the emotion code as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Yvette Miller-Monthrope, Fausto Ruggiero, Geraldine Glass, and Dr. Bradley Nelson. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, the Tonic newsletter with content curated personally by me will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.